Court. My name is Catherine Donahue from the Fairfax Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Reyes, who's asking this court to remand his case for a new sentencing hearing based on two assignments of error, the first being that the trial court erred in denying the continuance request that was made pursuant to Virginia Code Section 19.2-159.1. At the outset, I'd like to address counsel's argument that was raised in the Commonwealth's brief and then responded to in my reply about the issue of preservation. And as I explained in my reply brief, there were two separate motions that were before the court when it went to sentencing. There was the motion to substitute as counsel, and there was the motion to continue. And Mr. Swedish was very clear that if the motion to continue were granted, he'd ask that the motion to substitute as counsel be granted as well. And the Commonwealth takes issue with Mr. Swedish's statement on page 54 of the appendix where he says that would be fine upon the trial court's suggestion that he could sometime down the road file a motion to reconsider. But as I laid out in my reply brief, that acts as a remedy to the motion to substitute counsel issue. In order to get to a motion to reconsider, there has to have been a sentencing that took place. So that doesn't cure the denial of the continuance. That cures Mr. Swedish's position that he was unprepared to enter his appearance in the case at the sentencing date because he had just been retained. I'd also point to the court that there must be clear and unmistakable proof of a waiver before the court can find that this issue was not preserved. And a reasonable judge, and Judge Tran himself, would not interpret that remark as an abandonment of the earlier request for a continuance. On page 55 of the record is when we actually get the ruling from the trial court, and the court says, given the Commonwealth's objection, the motion to continue is denied. So even then, the court was treating the motion to continue as a contested issue. And because the Commonwealth was objecting, the court denied the continuance. Not because Mr. Swedish conceded that he was withdrawing that request, but the Commonwealth was objecting, and then the trial court denied the request to continue, and then stated that Mr. Swedish could enter his appearance at that time or at a later date. And so with regard to that, we asked the court to find that the issue is preserved with regard to the statutory violation here. Moving into the merits of the case, certainly this all comes down to what is the definition of trial within the statute. And I think there are several reasons why this court should find that trial needs to be encompassed to include the sentencing hearing in this case. The first is, as I explained on brief, the code section envisions that the indigency status shall remain in the case and go through all stages of the proceeding, so that at any point, if a defendant no longer is indigent, court-appointed counsel shall be withdrawn and retained counsel moves forward with the case. So the court, when looking at the language, yes, it says trial, but in the surrounding context of the statute, the language is also very clear that this status continues from whenever first arraigned all the way towards the end of the proceedings.
Let me ask you this. And forget about for a moment your second assignment of error, because you've got perhaps some preservation issues there. Why wouldn't this be harmless error? Because he was represented by counsel at sentencing.
I would point the court to London. And I know the court is familiar with that case. I believe you were on the panel that decided that court. And in London, the retained attorney did not enter his appearance at that time, and the case proceeded with court-appointed attorney. And so the case did proceed with counsel, but that did not render the error harmless. In fact, the court said that that was inconsistent with the requirements of the statute because it goes to the heart of this idea of representation of counsel, right to counsel of one's choosing.
But that's my point. That's a right to counsel. That's a Sixth Amendment right to counsel of one's choosing issue. And that's why I said forget about your second assignment of error. Suppose we decide not to address whether or not he was denied the right to counsel of his choosing because of the failure to raise that.
Then there would be no conceivable circumstance when this statute would be I guess the response to that is
You would then be relying purely on a statutory right to substitute counsel.
But if the court takes the position that any error made in denying a continuance under this statute is rendered harmless if they proceed with court-appointed counsel, then there could conceivably be no circumstance when a court would reverse and remand on a violation like this. There could be no reversible error for violation of the statute because the trial court would not allow a defendant to proceed without counsel.
Let me ask you then, the statute says the defendant shall thereupon obtain private counsel and shall forthwith advise the court of a change of circumstances, as you just noted. The court shall grant reasonable continuance to allow counsel to be obtained and to prepare for trial. Shortly after London was decided, this court also decided Johnson versus Commonwealth, where the court's pretty clear that there have to be exceptional circumstances if it's a last-minute request, which this was a last-minute request. In fact, it was the second continuing request at a last-minute request. So why is the trial court in error, having granted a last-minute request before, when the victim witness was put off her testimony? She came back again, and you've got, you know, just a number of things this time. The appellant had previously been granted a continuance request. The Commonwealth's witness is present. The Commonwealth's and defendant's appointed counsel were prepared to proceed with the sentencing. So why, in this situation, is the trial judge in error, given the statute says a reasonable continuance, and Johnson from this court says you have to have exceptional circumstances?
To begin with the reasonableness prong, I know the Commonwealth takes the position that the reasonableness, the use of the word reasonable relates to the reasonableness of the request, whether it's warranted or not. But I think from the statute, it's referring to the duration of the continuance in order to prepare for trial. And so we're looking at the word reasonable in the context of the duration. The request here was reasonable because it was a brief continuance.
But if you take your answer, I don't mean to interrupt you, but if you take your answer to its logical conclusion, let's say this happens a third time because Mr. Swedish, for whatever reason, says he can't do it, so now they've hired another attorney. Come August, because Mr. Swedish, I guess, asked until August. That was his suggestion. So you get to August, and it's like, well, now we've got Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones is going back to be my retained counsel. And Mr. Jones, we know it's the day of trial, the day before, but Mr. Jones needs time to prepare. So at some point, reasonable in the statute, especially given the way it's been interpreted by the court, on not just Johnson but other cases, it's got to mean something beyond a period of time that must be given every time.
Well, and I take issue with the court applying the last-minute continuance analysis to a violation of the statute because Johnson exclusively dealt with a Sixth Amendment analysis. And I don't believe that there's ever been a clear opinion that has solely addressed 159.1 in the context of a last-minute continuance request. Many of the cases are a blending of both the Sixth Amendment analysis and the 159.1 analysis. And so I don't think at any point in time there has been a case that has said under 159.1 the court must find, if it's a last-minute continuance request, that there were exceptional circumstances that warranted it, particularly in Johnson, as that was a Sixth Amendment claim. Regarding the court's...
Johnson isn't the only one. There are a number of cases that talk about you have to have exceptional circumstances. But I guess my question is, why, if the statute means every single time this happens, you have to get a reasonable continuance. In other words, you have to have a continuance.
But
does that work in reality?
The statute is triggered when a person is indigent and then no longer indigent. Assuming the court had granted the continuance on July 15th, Mr. Swedish's motion to substitute would have been granted. So he would have been in the case as retained counsel. If the court had come back in August and Mr. Reyes wanted to change counsel once again, this statute would not be implicated because he was no longer indigent as defined by statute and therefore would have to solely rely on the Sixth Amendment to effectuate the continuance, and then the court's analysis regarding last-minute continuances, countervailing state interests, and exceptional circumstances would apply. And so it only is triggered when someone goes from indigent to non-indigent.
And this was a case where the court did permit substitution of counsel.
So the Commonwealth indicated that the order, the sentencing order, does say that there was a motion to substitute granted and then withdrawn. But when you look at the actual record and go through the colloquy that occurred between the trial court, Mr. Swedish, and the Commonwealth, at no point does the court actually say that motion is granted. In fact, Mr. Swedish withdraws the motion on, I believe, page 56 or 55 of the record. And so while the trial court's order may have stated that, the record does not support that indication, that there was no actual true substitution of counsel. Mr. Swedish requested the continuance and said, if that is granted, I would ask to enter my appearance and substitute as counsel.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that Mr. Swedish turned down the opportunity? The court said, you can go ahead today, and we're going to let you substitute as counsel along with Mr. Court. And he declined the opportunity to even, to be co-counsel.
I don't think that has any bearing on the court's analysis on whether or not on July 15th the trial court erred in denying the continuance request pursuant to the statute. At that time, Mr. Swedish was prepared to enter his appearance. He was there, he was referring to Mr. Reyes as my client, and he was asking for a brief continuance to August to further prepare for the sentencing phase of the case. And so I don't believe whether or not Mr. Swedish actually entered into the case or not has any bearing, because just as in London, that wasn't a factor in the court's analysis determining whether there was a statutory violation. And so I guess when looking at then this idea of a trial, just very briefly, because I know I am into my rebuttal, trial, even in the narrowest sense of the word, is going to be a guilt phase and a sentencing phase of a case. And so I think even if you take the Commonwealth's argument that trial must be interpreted more narrowly and ignore that the right to be present under the Sixth Amendment in 192-259 and the right to be present under that Sixth Amendment has been applied broadly by the Supreme Court, even in the narrowest sense of the word, a sentencing phase is still a part of the trial. It's not until sentencing is concluded that there is official conviction or verdict in a case. And we know that because in cases that require proof of prior convictions, we're not just relying on a guilt conviction. We need there to have been an actual sentence imposed as well.
Counsel, how do you get past the plain meaning of the statute? I understand your Sixth Amendment argument, and I think Judge Petty is right that you're probably better off focusing on your statutory argument at this point, but how do you get past the plain meaning of the word trial?
And, Your Honor, again, I would point to this idea that trial, even in the narrowest sense of the word, has to be both a guilt phase and a sentencing phase. We are a bifurcated system here in Virginia, and even though this was not a jury case, there was a sentencing proceeding that was being conducted where the right to counsel still attached. And for that reason, trial must be broadly encompassed to include both the guilt phase and the sentencing phase. But even if you take it outside the word trial and consider the remainder of the statute, it would make no sense that once private counsel has been retained, court-appointed counsel shall forthwith be relieved of responsibility in the case. That would essentially mean that a person who retains counsel, as Mr. Reyes did, Mr. Nord is immediately relieved of his responsibilities. If the court doesn't grant the continuance, then there would be no counsel involved in the case. And so taking it to its most logical conclusion, it results in an absurd result. And I request to
extend your rebuttal a little bit to what it was when Judge Decker jumped in with that last second question. Mr. Sandoval.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chris Sandoval for the Commonwealth in this appeal. Mr. Reyes is arguing in this court that he had a statutory right to a continuance, to a second continuance and a second last-minute continuance of his sentencing hearing. But at the trial level, while he counseled Mr. Swedish initially made that argument, counsel subsequently abandoned that argument when the trial court gave counsel an alternative option. That alternative was, instead of continuing the case, the option given by the trial court to counsel was, why don't I just let you file a motion to reconsider after sentencing? And trial counsel said that would be fine. The standard changes after sentencing, but he did say that would be fine. In Buchanan versus Commonwealth, which is a case decided in 1989 by the Virginia Supreme Court, Supreme Court of Virginia held that that exact same statement, quote, that would be fine, constituted a waiver of an argument that trial counsel had earlier made. The court had not yet ruled on the motion in that case. In that case, it was a motion to allow a court-appointed psychiatrist to visit the scene of the crime along with the defendant and the defense counsel. And the trial court asked defense counsel, you know, why don't I just let you and your client visit the scene and not allow the court-appointed psychiatrist to visit the scene? Defense counsel said, quote, that would be fine. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that waived his earlier argument that he was entitled to have that court-appointed psychiatrist also visit the scene of the crime. That is exactly what occurred here. Defense counsel initially argued under the statute, we are entitled to have this continuance. The trial court discussed the possibility of giving this continuance, even asked counsel, how much time do you think you would need? This is on page 54 of the record. The court said it's a burden on the victims if I give another continuance. On page 53, Mr. Swedish said, I understand, Your Honor. That's why I didn't try to force the issue, but I brought it to the attention of the court. So already beginning to back off of that argument that he was entitled to it, and then subsequently the court said, how much time do you need? He suggested an amount of time. And then on the next page, on page 54, the court said, why don't I just allow you to file a motion to reconsider before he is sentenced with the Department of Corrections? And Mr. Swedish says that would be fine. The eventual ruling on the motion for a continuance comes on page 55, where the court asks the Commonwealth, what's the Commonwealth's position? What does the Commonwealth prefer? Commonwealth said, we would prefer to do it today because we have a victim present. And then the court does rule and say, okay, I deny the continuance motion. By the point that the court ruled on the motion, I would submit that all that was before the court was an early request by defense counsel that we would like a continuance, but also a concession by defense counsel on page 54 that the alternative would also be fine. The alternative of continuing with sentencing on that day, allowing new counsel to substitute in and file a subsequent motion to reconsider. And so at that point, the trial court was just dealing with, okay, defense counsel would prefer we continue it, but isn't insisting on it. The Commonwealth would prefer we do it today. And so the trial court got to make the judgment call, and the trial court decided we're going to go ahead and do the sentencing today, and we'll allow new counsel an opportunity to file a motion to reconsider later. That is a very different circumstance than the argument that we have now, which is that the trial court erred because Mr. Reyes was statutorily entitled to have that continuance granted. Because he backed away from that issue is waived and Buchanan is controlling. Dickinson is a newer case decided by this court. More recently, it's unpublished, but it's similar circumstances where this court held it was waived as well.
I'd like to ask you about the Sixth Amendment issue, the second assignment of error.
Yes, Your Honor.
We all recognize, I think, from the record that there was no specific argument made to the trial court that this would deny the defendant his Sixth Amendment right to counsel of his choice. Appellant is asking that we consider the issue under the ends of justice exception. Why would it not always be a miscarriage of justice if the defendant is denied his Sixth Amendment right to counsel of his choice?
I would submit, Your Honor, that Virginia courts have never gone that far, and this is not the case.
A denial of right to counsel of his choice per the Supreme Court of the United States can never be considered as harmless error. It is a fundamental right.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that the circumstances of this case prove. So if there were a clear indication that he was denied his right to be represented by the counsel of his choice, on the facts, on the record of this case, maybe we'd have a different circumstance, and maybe it would be a better case for an ends of justice exception to apply.
But shouldn't we address that? We've had two arguments already today dealing with a denial of a constitutional right being considered as a potential actual miscarriage of justice. And I don't know that we have any case law that addresses the ends of justice in that context. And I think perhaps a Sixth Amendment denial of counsel of one's choice is one of the strongest constitutional rights that we could address. And I don't know how we could ever say it's not a miscarriage of justice to deny somebody the right to the attorney of their choice.
Well, I think in doing the ends of justice analysis, courts have consistently, Virginia courts have consistently, there is some merits analysis, a quasi-merits analysis that is incorporated within that ends of justice analysis. If there were any indication of, in the record that he were denied his Sixth Amendment right to be represented by counsel of his choice, then perhaps the court might then hold that we should do an ends of justice application. In this particular case, I don't think this is the right case to hold that the ends of justice could apply to denial of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, because it's clear, as Your Honor made clear earlier, he was given the opportunity to be represented by the counsel of his choice, and he actually was represented by the counsel of his choice for a period of time at the sentencing hearing based on the order that was entered. And counsel subsequently withdrew and then decided not to file anything subsequently. So I think the ultimate, there may come a case where this court can and should decide that, or might decide that the ends of justice exception should apply when it's the Sixth Amendment denial of counsel of one's choosing. But this is just not yet that case based on the record.
Your argument is that, as I take it, that there was no Sixth Amendment denial here, so therefore we don't even need to go to ends of justice.
Well, it's just plain on the record that we don't come anywhere close to a denial of the Sixth Amendment right to be represented by counsel of your choice. Because of that, this court should not reach the full merits of that case and get past the ends of justice exception requirement, because that analysis should stop short based on the record we have here.
And just to be clear, what in the record reflects that it's not a Sixth Amendment violation?
So for a last-minute continuance, the courts have held under the Sixth Amendment, if you're requesting a last-minute continuance, there have to be exceptional circumstances in the record. There were no exceptional circumstances here requiring that continuance to obtain new counsel. It was conceded that appointed counsel was prepared and ready to go forward with sentencing. The only argument that was made as to why new counsel might want to be obtained is because there had been some discussion about possibly filing a motion to withdraw the guilty plea. There were no specifics as to what the basis for that motion might have been. It's just something that had been discussed. It wasn't even clear at the time the motion was made who that discussion had been had with, if even the defendant had any interest in withdrawing his guilty plea. The conversation with new counsel had been with the defendant's family, not with the defendant. As I said, the motion was filed at the very last minute. This was the second last-minute motion for a continuance, not the first one. So circumstances, other than the fact that the family was representing, they had money to hire an attorney to take another shot at maybe getting a better outcome, circumstances really hadn't changed, and there wasn't any sort of showing of any sort of exceptional circumstances.
The fact that the court was going to let Mr. Swedish go forward, but and even go forward that day with Mr. Nord, I think his name was.
Yes, sir.
That didn't effectively deny any sort of Sixth Amendment, if we were to get to the merits, Sixth Amendment right to counsel of your choosing, because he wasn't prepared that day.
Correct, Your Honor, because the Sixth Amendment right to counsel of your choosing does not mean that anytime you walk into court and say, hey, I'd like to have a different counsel today and I need a continuance, that doesn't mean you're automatically entitled to a continuance so you can choose someone new. There are limitations on that.
This is actually somewhat similar to the facts in Hughley versus Commonwealth, where there were two attorneys representing the defendant at trial. One was sick, couldn't be present. The defendant asked for a continuance to allow the second attorney to be there. The court denied the continuance, and we held that that was not a Sixth Amendment violation.
Correct, Your Honor. And at the time that this motion for continuance was made and Mr. Swedish represented that he'd been hired to come into the case, there was no representation, as far as my reading of the record, that the defendant himself, Mr. Reyes, actually wanted this new counsel to be appointed. There was a representation that a conversation had been had with the family, but there was no representation at the time that this was counsel of the defendant's own choosing. The defendant subsequently, just prior to being sentenced, said, I actually thought this was going to get continued, and I thought that I would have a chance to maybe withdraw. But that sort of representation was never made at the time that the motion was made to continue so that new counsel could be appointed.
Can you address Ms. Donahue's argument that the statute essentially mandates a continuance if you're moving from, even if you've had previous ones, and even if it's last minute, if you are moving from court-appointed counsel to now retained counsel?
I think all of the statute mandates, and this is what she said in her reply brief, that all that it mandates is a grant of a reasonable continuance to prepare for trial, because that's what it says. And so the insertion of the word reasonable there, Virginia courts have repeatedly held, that implies some degree of deference, some degree, not deference, but some degree of discretion on the part of trial.
It's not a reasonable time that must be granted. It's a question of a reason the court can make a reasonable decision there.
The question is whether the request itself is reasonable. And I think that encompasses more than just the amount of time that's being asked for. It also encompasses, is this the first request for a continuance or the second request? Was this request made weeks before the scheduled hearing, or is this request made the day before the scheduled hearing, which is what happened here? So in the Sixth Amendment context, there is that reasonable analysis that takes place. Again, you're not automatically entitled to a continuance based on your Sixth Amendment right. It still has to be reasonable, and all those factors are considered. I think those similar principles are embodied here with the insertion of the word reasonable within the statute. You still consider the factors that Virginia courts have considered in cases like Braley, where the continuance is made at the last minute for the second time.
You make the argument that trial does not include sentencing. It seems to me that that's not one of your stronger arguments, but I want to give you an opportunity to address it. Clearly it's an incident of trial. I mean, clearly you're entitled to counsel at sentencing because it is an incident of trial. Suppose this were a capital case and the defendant was found guilty of capital murder, and then we moved to sentencing. And at that point, defendant is able to retain counsel, chooses to do so, new counsel comes in. Would you argue that that new counsel is not entitled to a continuance for purposes of sentencing in a capital case because it's not trial?
Well, I think when we're interpreting the statute, our goal is to determine, you know, what do the words of the statute mean? And there might be an argument in your circumstance and in the circumstance here that there's a separate Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
No, I'm solely under the statute.
Right. So my response would be, one, there, I think you could conclude that the General Assembly would mean for the word trial to include the sentencing stage of a jury trial. That is a fair conclusion. And so in your hypothetical,
why wouldn't it include the sentencing phase of a bench trial or a guilty plea?
Well, because I think the word trial has been used in the jury trial context and in some case law to talk about a bifurcated trial and the fact that there's...
Well, the court takes evidence at any sentencing proceedings. The Commonwealth is required to prove facts that would enhance sentencing. A sentencing can be a mini trial. Often it's the most important part of trial.
Well, I think it could be analogous to a trial in a lot of ways, but I don't think the word trial is used in the context of a bench sentencing hearing in the same way that it's sometimes used in the context of a jury sentencing in a bifurcated trial. And so what we're trying to get at is, what did the General Assembly intend when they used that word trial?
The General Assembly intended to save money. I mean, that's the intent of this statute, is to relieve court-appointed counsel and let the defendant pocket his reach into his own pocket for expenses, and why shouldn't we allow them to do that?
Well, but there are some limitations on that, and that's where the word reasonable comes into play, and that's where
Agreed.
The word trial also comes into play. I would submit, when it is a last minute motion to prepare for a hearing other than the actual trial, take this case as an example. There's the argument made that once circumstances had changed and he'd obtained new counsel, that couldn't have ever happened again. It was only going to happen once ever. We know from the motion that Mr. Nord filed post-sentencing, he filed a motion to set aside and to reconsider and to withdraw the guilty plea. And in that motion, and I think that I've highlighted it in my... I think it was the second motion filed, and I did mention this in my brief. There was a representation made by Mr. Nord that he had received a voicemail from Mr. Swedish in which Mr. Swedish represented that the family had not been able to pay that retainer. And as a result, Mr. Swedish was not going to represent Mr. Reyes, and as a result, it fell back to Mr. Nord to continue to represent Mr. Reyes. So if that motion to continue had been granted, the parties would have come back before the court on that new date, that new sentencing hearing date. Mr. Swedish would have come and said, I haven't been retained. The circumstances have changed back. He's no longer able to hire someone. So now we need to put appointed counsel back in the case and maybe request another continuance.
Let me ask you a practical, from a practical standpoint, if we disagree with your argument, I know you're sure we won't, but if we happen to disagree with your argument, what is the remand? Do we just remand this back for sentencing?
Hadn't thought that far ahead, so I don't want to speak just off the cuff.
You always ought to anticipate you're not going to win.
Right. Yes, I think at the most it would be a remand for a new sentencing. But again, he was given the opportunity to have the counsel of his choice at that sentencing hearing. He decided not to because he wasn't prepared. But I do think in order to reach that conclusion, this court has to find both that the request was reasonable and that trial means any stage of the proceedings. And because the General Assembly repeatedly in statutes around 159.1 uses other words like hearing and all stage of the proceedings and criminal hearings, use those words elsewhere, but use trial here. It's clear that they meant something different when they said trial here.
That the additional motion to reconsider that was discussed, with regard to a number of things here, was filed timely, but not ruled on until 21 days past the sentencing order.
Any differences in terms of the outcome of the case?
How it affects this assignments of error in this case.
Right, so I did notice that, and I thought it was interesting. At the time the court ruled on it, the court, of course, had the authority to still reconsider the sentence because he had not been transferred to the Department of Corrections. So he had that authority. But you're correct, he did not have authority to do more than that. But the reason those motions weren't filed in a timely manner was the result of the fact that the family wasn't ultimately able to pay Mr. Swedish, so he had to withdraw from the case. So the very sort of delays in proceedings that the General Assembly is trying to avoid, I think, would have occurred here, but for the denial of that last-minute request for a continuance, we ask the court to
thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll put a total of 3 minutes on the clock. We extended Mr. Chandeville's, and we cut you off a little bit. But could you address, I noticed in your brief you asked that this be remanded back for new trial. Would that really be the appropriate remedy, or we just remand it back for sentencing?
I requested a new sentencing hearing.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Dunn, can I ask you with regard to what trial means?
That's why I showed
it. We have the motion to reconsider after the sentencing hearing and so forth. If trial means from arraignment to the end, suppose Mr. Swedish had said, or some retained counsel had said, I would like to, the family would like for me to represent on the motion to reconsider. We filed this motion to reconsider on the 19th day, and Your Honor, I want it set for a hearing, and I want to be the one handling this. It's still in the trial court stage. Would at that point a continuance have to be granted? The court didn't have to, hold it in abeyance, obviously, to get past the 21-day rule.
So if I understand Your Honor's question, the sentencing would have been concluded and a new attorney would have come in after sentencing.
Or would be requesting to come in to handle the motion to reconsider and an attempt to get a hearing on, because it's still in the trial court's bosom.
At that point, there wouldn't be a pending court date, so there wouldn't be a need to request a continuance because the trial court does
even
not...
Even if he's trying to set, he has a motion to set a hearing to hear his motion.
The trial court does not have to set a hearing date on a motion to reconsider, so a retained counsel would merely have to file the motion, request that it be heard, and if the trial court chose not to, that wouldn't be a denial of right to counsel, that wouldn't be anything like that.
So you're saying effectively trial ends at sentencing?
Yes, at this point, yes, and I think that's in line with the statute. I think the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment most likely extends past that because there have been habeas cases, for instance, where an attorney hasn't followed up on a trial court's invitation.
No, actually, I think the Supreme Court just ruled that the Sixth Amendment right for counsel ends at sentencing.
Well, then I stand corrected. I know our office, this idea of representation post-sentencing is a little murky, and perhaps we'll take that as a proper guidance on it.
I don't mean to take you off what
you wanted. Did you have anything else you wanted
to? Your Honor, just briefly to address Mr. Chandeville's points. In regard to whether or not Mr. Reyes wanted to proceed with Mr. Swedish, we have the fact that Mr. Swedish was retained, appeared in court, requested the continuance, and also said that he had discussed with the client about withdrawing the guilty pleas. So that implies that there were attorney-client discussions between the two, and then there was no point where Mr. Reyes voiced an objection to Mr. Swedish. In fact, later on page 82 of the record during allocution, he says, "I thought I would be asking to withdraw my guilty pleas." And looking at whether or not this is a miscarriage of justice, I would just point the court to this idea, and if I may briefly conclude that point. When examining whether or not a miscarriage of justice has occurred, certainly we have to look at what happened after the denial. Mr. Swedish, if he had entered his appearance on the sentencing date, had already said he would be unprepared and therefore not ready to move forward. So there's a Hobson's choice there for Mr. Reyes. He either proceeds with court-appointed counsel, who Mr. Swedish says is prepared for sentencing, but that's the only concession from a different attorney, not the trial court. Or he proceeds with attorney of his choosing who has already admitted he'd be ineffective because he's not prepared and has just come into the case. And I think that's important for the court when analyzing whether there's a miscarriage of justice to remember that when an attorney is coming in late, it is late because it is the day of trial, he can't be presumed able to move forward that day if he hasn't been able to prepare.
Thank you very much for your argument. Do you agree, counsel? And then we will stand adjourned for the session.